19th. We have a public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 5515, Department of Higher Education. And good afternoon. We have President Dave Frohnmayer from the University of Oregon and Mr. Fred Ziari, the Vice Chair Engineering and Technology Industry Council, ETIC, and Bill McGee, that's budget. So good afternoon, gentlemen. Sorry for the late start. And as I think Senator Deckard said, I think some of our Senate colleagues, or Senate and House colleagues,
the Joint Committee,
have on a rural county tour. So,
which those of us in the rural areas are very appreciative of, I might add.
Wonderful. So I think I'm turning it over to you, President Frohnmayer.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. Chair Glazio, members of the committee. For the record, Dave Frohnmayer, President of the University of Oregon, testifying on behalf of the measure before you. Let me introduce, as you already have recognized, Fred Ziari, who will be speaking after I do. He is from the Engineering Technology and Industry Council. He's Vice Chair of ETIC, President and CEO of EZ Wireless, which is based in Hermiston and in Portland. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to recap very briefly what you heard the last time you testified, we hope to have identified what's been happening with public higher education and the consequences of disinvestment in that system over the last number of years. You've heard about the effects of erratic and unstable funding. You've heard why this matters to Oregon. You've heard that we risk losing the best and brightest of faculty and students, and this is not some ephemeral threat. This is something that is very real to us, particularly in the midst of this recruiting season in which we're engaged right now. We know that we won't have enough replacement parts when the baby boomers leave if we don't put them through our own system at prices that they can afford with the quality that they need. You've heard how research drives student success and Oregon's economic success, and those themes will continue today in my testimony and those who will follow. My particular mission today is to try to answer from you a big question, which is, what is the state's return on investment in higher education? The answer to that, to summarize and go right to the bottom line, is it's big and it can be quantified. And I'll do my very best to identify to you some of the dimensions of that quantification that show you this isn't just something, again, that is a will-o'-the-wisp, but something tangible and concrete that comes from a vibrant higher education system. Our universities bring significant dollars, both from within, but mostly from outside the state of Oregon, the vast majority of which is spent in Oregon. We also generate human capital, which is essential for the knowledge economy that I think we all know about, but sometimes don't appreciate enough until we see that its benefits may go to other places in the globe. Our universities are filled with people with ideas. That's going to be the basis of economic power and the attraction of business. Let me begin with three slides for which the committee didn't have time to conclude in the last session, and these, I think, actually provide a nice introduction. I will be brief in identifying them, but I think that they show in stark graphic term some of the important stage setting that the committee, I think, probably doesn't even need reminding of, but which we would like to make part of the record. The first is the raw fact that OUS student funding has declined since 1990. There was a brief respite in the year 2000, coming from the 1999 legislative session, when a deliberate attempt was made by the legislature to enhance the budget beyond what the governor then had proposed. That was followed by dramatic increases in student enrollment, but as you can see, that funding was unstable and declined rather quickly to a point where it is now less than it was in 1990. A sad but true fact. In real dollars and in inflated dollars, it's less for higher education than it was 15 years ago. That isn't where the rest of the world is going. The rest of the world understands the importance of this investment. And that takes us maybe to our next slide, which shows that notwithstanding this relative deprivation, research, which is competitively obtained, is actually increasing in terms of expenditures. Again, this research money comes by and large almost exclusively outside of the state of Oregon and is expended within the state of Oregon on high-wage, high-professional jobs and results in scientific, technological, and other discoveries that lead directly to the infusion of wealth and energy and knowledge into our economy. I'll be speaking, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, primarily about the efforts of the three research universities is in the system. But I wish it had been known for the record that everyone is engaged in research. For example, Southern Oregon University has experts in viticulture that are world recognized. Western Oregon University has nationally recognized expertise in education, in teaching and learning, and those processes. OIT is showing the entire world how to use geothermal power and how to become energy self-sufficient within a geographic area itself. Eastern Oregon University's new science center is providing a beacon of hope for science education for the entire 10-county area of Eastern Oregon, which it serves most directly, and for the rest of the state, as well as our public services and private enterprise. So we can't afford to lose research no matter where we are, and it's important no matter where we are. A brief graphic, if I might, our final slide of sort of catch-up, shows the effect of disinvestment on students and on the state of Oregon. It leads to negative decreases and increases. The negative decreases are in the aspirations of kids who say, I can't afford it anymore, or I believe I can't afford it, the sticker shock. It leads to reduced freshman participation if economic turmoil is too great. The kids drop out, and we know that if they drop out in a freshman year, the likelihood of completing a college education is very, very much reduced. Graduation rates are affected the same way as degree production, high-skilled worker production, and so forth. And if you're faced with declining enrollments, then of course you lead directly on the upside of the bad side to tuition increases, to the need for more financial aid, increased time to graduation, all of the negatives, and hydraulics, I hate to use that term, but it's probably a pretty good one, with which the committee is familiar. So we don't want to have a circling the drain mentality. We want the tub to be filling. And that's why it's important that we talk about investment in higher education as investment, not as a cost. If I were to have a single graphic and do some of the cartoons, instead of a sponge, I'd say it's a spark plug. Because for a relatively small investment, in fact, a declining investment, we'll be able to show you in the next few minutes that, in fact, the return on investment is staggeringly high, and that even a modest increase in the investment would lead to an even greater return on investment that goes to the bottom line, pocketbooks, civic life of the entire state of Oregon. I think you know that education pays. This is just to renew a graphic that shows you the median earnings of Oregonians, far greater if you have a college education than if you don't. The difference between a person with a high school diploma and a graduate degree is easily $1 million in earning power over a lifetime. $1 million. That's whether you have a ticket to the American middle class, to opportunity, to a chance of liberation, or whether you end up being nickeled and dimed, in Barbara Ehrenreich's words. I think it's that great. That gulf in terms of social and economic class is increasingly defined by educational attainment. We know it, but these figures, I think, help to estimate that and show it clearly. We can compare the investments in higher education relative to other things that we invest in. Of course, you know that you invest more per K-12 student than you do for higher education. You invest five times as much on an annual basis in each prisoner in higher education, in the correction system, as you do for students in higher education. We understand the difficulties of those comparisons, but they are nonetheless graphic. Let's talk about employment and protecting our employment base, and what a good, solid, good wage-earning professional employment base does for a state. What you find here is that the Oregon University system is the state's third largest employer, and these are good jobs. They're generally stable through times of economic downturn. They are a reverse stabilizer in terms of the economic cycle. And it tells us something about knowing what we would do to protect the existence and increase the business climate for all of these other employers. I think it's helpful to carry that attitude the same way in terms of higher education as an employer and as a revenue generator for the state of Oregon. These are stable expenditures. They involve payroll. They involve construction. If you just take the basic revenue generated by the state system and take away from it the investment of state appropriations, the net to the state of Oregon is minimally $2.05 billion a year. That's one way to calculate the return on investment from the system. That's combined earned revenue more than that of Columbia Forest Products, Pacific Seafood Group, Bi-Mart, and Reeser's Fine Foods, just to pick a few. put before you, ladies and gentlemen, a copy of the economic impact brochure of the University of Oregon, with the assurance that I will cover equivalent data, at least in overall summary, for Portland State University and Oregon State University as well. But I do commend to you a brochure that's readable. It's been peer-reviewed, prepared by professional economists using conservative identifiers, and these are the bottom lines. That for an investment of a little bit more than $60 million a year in general funds at the University of Oregon, and that's all we get, it's about 13% of our budget, we generate directly and indirectly, but traceably, $1.2 billion a year. That's a 20-to-1 return on investment. If you were private investors, or if I were, and if this were available for a stock sale, I'd sure want in on the IPO, and I'd want to hold the stock, because that's the kind of return investment that documented like this would be very hard to find duplicated on a year-in, year-out basis. And the same is true of our colleagues in Portland State and Oregon State University as well. And of the $60 million in appropriation which we received last year, I don't know whether I'm proud or chagrined to report to you that our own employees paid $12 million of it in their income taxes. So that we're part of the taxpaying public that in turn produces revenue that goes to the appropriation that we receive. So how do we power the state's economy? Well, we do it in five ways, and I'll touch on each of those very briefly because it's helpful, I think, to see each of these components operating separately, and each of these can be calculated, each of these can be estimated for each of our major research universities. First, to research and technology transfer. Again, it may be counterintuitive, and it's a tribute to the quality of our staff, even given the declining state appropriation, that our research expenditures brought in from outside, by and large from the federal government, have actually increased 67% at the University of Oregon over the last 5 years. Interestingly enough, they've increased 67% over the last 5 years at Portland State University as well. We're nearly at $100 million a year in those peer-reviewed, very competitive research grants that come on the basis of basically a stable federal research budget. So our scientists are competitive, our education experts are competitive, notwithstanding the relative privation of their salaries and the difficulties we may have of keeping them. We've created 60-plus companies in recent years through the research that we've been creating. Per research dollar, we're one of the top research universities in terms of per capita discoveries. And last year, licensing, patent, and other income generated from these discoveries gave $4 million to our bottom line. That would have been unheard of 10 years ago, but it's a reality now. I'll cite similar figures for Oregon State and Portland State in just a moment. The total sponsored research, in other words, of our universities is in excess of $313 million a year, a third of $1 billion a year that they brought in because they are research institutions from sources outside the state to spend inside the state. And it results in things that are a big deal. The neural net, for example, this issue of National Geographic you may have seen. The University of Oregon neural researcher helped to provide the research that led to the mapping of the brain and mind and understanding some of the basic things that happen in everything from stroke victims to how people learn. The same thing in a recent article about your baby's brain that was found in Newsweek magazine. That is a discovery not done in some distant neuroscience laboratory in Harvard University. It's done at the University of Oregon. We're proud of it. We need to sustain it. It's one of the cutting-edge fields of understanding the very nature of human consciousness itself, but it doesn't happen by some happy accident. Out-of-state tuition dollars is the second major source of our out-of-state money and revenue generation. It may come as a surprise to you that we generated more money from out-of-state tuition than we did from the state's general fund last biennium. But that depends on a couple of very key things, the primary one of which is have the appearance of quality, we have to produce the quality in order for those students who pay 2 to 3 times the going rate of Oregon students will still come to the University of Oregon because they see value. International students comprise $15 million of our income. Again, they come to us bring money from not only outside the region, but actually outside the United States. That's a major source that helps to power the state's economy. A third generator of the state's economy is capital construction. no big surprise, really, but you know how vibrant, how powerful that is as an engine, particularly in times of economic downturn. We would not have been able to do that without state bonding authority, which we've received from the legislature. At the same time, state bonding authority is in some respects a relatively small part. It just happens to be the leverage that we need in order to generate private donations, and we generate them on a very big scale, and that goes directly to construction workers. That directly feeds as the construction industry's powerful multiplier into local economies and puts food and shelter with our citizens. We have $102 million more slated for projects in the next few years, assuming at least that we can get the bonding authority that we asked for in this budget, but which apparently doesn't presently exist as a proposal from the co-chair's budget, something that I think you know is a major issue with us in terms of what needs to be done, not only in terms of new construction, but also deferred maintenance and some of the other key capital needs that we have for a major resource.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker?
Thank you. President Fromer, just a question on that. I'm looking at the Integrated Science Complex, and I don't know, and I don't have the brochure in front of, and maybe it's up here.
Let me show you my next slide.
Is it that? And the question, if you don't, if you make it into the next slide, in that analysis, is there the private money that goes to a capital construction project? I know there's a gift been, and I don't know if it's delivered or is in the works for the science complex. Have we measured in that economic analysis what the tax revenue that Oregon, because we're debating right now whether to match that or not in capital. It would be interesting to know, it would bolster the argument to know that if $20 million in private dollars are allocated, or what is the tax revenue of a $40 million building project for the state to put in 20 of that, and obviously the bonding, we only do a portion of that in 07-09.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Deckard, let me try to answer it this way, and I want to be as direct as I can and tell you where my assumptions are as well as the realities are. We've requested bonding for $30 million of building, which we propose to match with $30 million of private funding. We've raised $20 million already. There's a donor who loves the University of Oregon, who understands science very well, who understands the running of colleges and universities very well, whose roots are in Oregon, and who believes deeply that we can do some major things in science if we have integrative sciences building phase two. He's made the $20 million commitment. I don't want to be the university president who goes to him and says, we can't use your money because the state isn't able to uphold what we thought we'd be able to ask them for, and what the governor assured this donor personally that he would try to do in his budget. But this is for a science complex that is science at the cutting edge. So we know that it is going to be internationally competitive for federal funding many times over the order of the construction costs of the building, because it will house neuroscience, it will house nanoscience, it will house molecular biology, it will provide the quarters for cutting edge science and the best laboratories, that in turn makes our scientists the most competitive for these federal grants. And I can tell you, anytime you have capital construction facility of that kind, that over the lifetime of that building, it's going to generate a multiplier of whatever it is that the state provides. So I would say it's in the tens of millions of dollars, Senator Deckard. I wish I could be more precise. It'll be tens of millions of dollars in the relatively short run, in my view, given the quality of the scientific units that we would move there, with the laboratories that would become more competitive for the scientists who will be in them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that responsive to your question?
Yes, President Fromer. And just a thought, Mr. Chair, not a question, is it would be interesting, and maybe we just pick one or two projects as we consider capital construction for higher ed, since it's unique to higher ed of having that private match sitting there, that we do some sort of analysis of what is the detriment to the state of Oregon, not just for 2 years, but long term, of not doing a project in terms of tax revenue. And I know we can gin up our economists. I'm happy to help in LRO to do some sort of analysis if we were to choose not to go forward with the project, and using both the state money and then the private money, what are the ramifications of that on state revenue, obviously in the short term, but also in the long term?
Thank you, Senator Deckard. Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, in that vein, we have heard bits and pieces about the capital construction budget and the amount of monies that have been committed privately. if we could pull all of that together for all of the institutions so that we know what the expectation is for general obligation bonds and what the private amount of money is that has been committed or at least anticipated in the near term, so that we can analyze really the true effect. I mean, walking away from $20 million is a... That's a hard swallow.
Well, it's beyond embarrassment. Well, I mean, because it's a statement of retreat in the face of where everyone else is going. And really, I think in a very short-sighted analysis of where states, the state's investment pays off. In this case, we know this is money at hand. We know that the incentive of having the state match it through bonding authority is a powerful incentive for giving at this level, because that way the donor says, I can really see something in my lifetime that results from this. If the state doesn't choose to participate in something that's supposed to be for the benefit of the state's citizens, it has a sour taste and ought to leave a sour taste. To Senator Deckert's question, if I may, I think in short order and quite quickly and with some accuracy, we could show you the benefits of the state bonding leverage in the recent capital construction over the last dozen years at the University of Oregon, which is actually less than half of the money that we have paid for it, but nonetheless constitutes the base leverage that allows private donations to come at the level that they have.
So I think it would be very helpful.
And we could show you
construction workers.
Yeah, we could make intelligent guesses based upon the productivity of the scientists who occupy those buildings and the level of federal research dollars that they are typically able to generate. The kind of return on investment that is likely to come based on the productivity of those scientists. And while you understand that there is some estimating involved with that, it's also not pie in the sky. It's based upon productivity records and the likely leverage of improved facilities in terms of improved competitiveness for limited numbers of federal dollars. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the next of the fourth of the levers that help to power the state's economy are obviously those that come from the value of a knowledge economy itself. I think we've talked about what that means. The college degree is about $1 million more over a lifetime. Our graduating class in the year 2005 will generate over a lifetime $280 million in income tax revenue. That's a pretty solid number based upon its demographics and where those people are settling. They more than pay for the University of Oregon education at nearly five times the level. And finally, something I've alluded to already very quickly, the leverage of private gifts that comes from the investment of state dollars. We've raised in our current campaign $500 million of funding. That'll be funding for student scholarships. It'll help to double the university's endowment. It supports research. It'll double the size of endowment devoted to faculty. I'm quite sure that we will make our goal, and what that means is even a greater and richer environment for all of Oregonians within the state's borders. Let me turn now, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, very quickly to my sister universities. Oregon State's economic footprint is even bigger than ours. It's about $1.5 billion a year, done by the same kinds of methodologies that I think quite literally one can take to the bank. It includes both employment and economic impacts, and in OSU's case, because of the extension service, it's all 36 Oregon counties have a footprint economically and that deals directly with the vibrancy of those local economies. Last year, OSU earned $184 million in research funding and expended a record $194 million, nearly $200 million in research expenditures. Its tech transfer money was $2.13 million in income, which was an institutional record and more than a 10% increase over the previous year. Just to put faces on this, four big ideas that currently are occurring at our sister university. In the left-hand photo, Professor Annette Von Juan has a prototype of a wave energy buoy that could harvest the ocean's energy. I know that members of this assembly have been informed of this in other respects, but this is part of the Oregon Inc. proposal. Again, this is not something that's any longer a science fiction dream. It's something that a renowned scientist is able to do that has a direct impact on Oregon's energy future. In the top middle photo is a micro dialyzer. It's not much bigger than the size of a dime. It can be used in existing dialysis equipment and home dialysis. It helps directly address not only patient inconvenience and patient longevity, but the very high costs of the healthcare system that actually can be reduced. The top right photo is Professor Kai-Ching Lee from the Department of Wood Science and Engineering at Oregon State. He's developing non-toxic soy-based adhesives and wood plastic composites, which are just some of the new products being developed at OSU that have exciting ramifications for us all. At the bottom is a transparent transistor, which I take some risk in holding up to you, but here's what it looks like if you can see through it. This little device is made of zinc clean oxide, but it has the capacity of being included in glassware that is, for example, in automobile windshields that could in turn receive communications warning motorists about hazardous conditions or accidents ahead of them. It can be used for low-cost LCD screens, flexible displays of all kinds. Again, that's not being done at some distant laboratory in Asia. It's happening just 40 miles south of here in Corvallis. It's a directly supported research idea that I hope gives some graphic indication that great things are happening. At Portland State University, you have before you an image of the economic impact brochure, and I won't repeat because of issues of time what's contained within that. Portland State's economic impact, again, it can be peer-reviewed. It's probably conservative in terms of the multiplier. It's $1.068 billion of economic impact. So add that together with the three research universities, it's easily over $3 billion a year, and that is almost exclusive of the state's appropriation. I mentioned that PSU's research funding's increased by 67% over the last 5 years. Much of it is collaborative research, and we know that because they work with us. They work with OSU and the Pacific Northwest Laboratories in the ONAMI project, as well as in Oregon's Lab 2 Market Initiative. You'll hear more about the PSU initiatives from one of their leading researchers, from whom you'll hear in just a few moments. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I wanted to say that we no longer play on a framework and within boundaries that are defined by some states' artificial geographic limits. I've given you a graphic display of the Association of Pacific Rim Universities, which our university helped to found 10 years ago. The presidents of each of these universities are people whom I know on a first-name basis. We meet at least once annually in a location in one or another of our hemispheres. These are the leading research universities of the Asian Pacific world, and we study everything from volcanism and tsunamis to the rights of indigenous peoples, to area health, to how you build sustainable environments in river valleys that are increasingly polluted, with the world's growing population, at the same time dealing with some of the world's most dynamic economies. We're players in that, just as our colleagues at Portland State and Oregon State are. Their list of locations would be just as robust as this one is. But it's a way of saying that we're an international global economy. If we don't understand how to play in it effectively, we doom our citizens to be second-class citizens and indeed probably someone else's economic colony. I'm proud enough as a native Oregonian to say that isn't the fit I want for our children, and it's not one that we have to have for them based upon the investment that we've made already in the robustness of what we can do, I think demonstrably by some of the facts and figures that I've helped to share with you today. Our public universities have an incredible return on the state's investment, but the floor of that investment is absolutely critical, and at the bottom of it is the capacity to educate our citizens for the next generation in ways that will keep them attracted, staying in state, providing them with the most important critical thinking and leadership skills, and giving them a sense of global engagement that's absolutely essential if they're to be successful. This isn't just an expenditure. It is a modest expenditure, but it is, beyond that, an investment in Oregon's future. I would challenge you as you consider each of the requests for appropriation that is made to you, no matter across what spectrum, to ask whether there is anything by way of facts and figures and documentation that would show the level of return on investment that I've tried to show to you modestly and conservatively today based on data that we can verify. It's a matter of pride that I think we can do that. It's my hope that you will take that with the seriousness of purpose that we offer it to you. And I do thank you for your courtesy today.
Thank you very much, President Fellmeyer. Does anyone have any questions? Or?
All right. Can we continue on?
I just want to comment. I always appreciate hearing from President Frommeyer because he talks about the importance of higher education in terms of the economy, also in terms of educating our students. But there is an economic return, and you've shown that before in the documentation you provided us, and you've shown that today in the creativity. Yes, I've had this before. And it's still the same, and what isn't the same is this budget hasn't been funded in a way that honors what we can do here. So I appreciate your comments today.
Thank you, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, and take care. So, Mr. Ziari, are you, I think I have you next.
What happened?
I don't know. Were you playing sports on the weekend, Mr. President?
I'm sorry.
Were you playing sports on the weekend?
It's called not skiing exactly where you want it to go.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sports on the weekend.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Fred Ziari. I'm the president of Easy Wireless and IRZ Consulting in Hermiston, members of committee, Mr. Chairman, and also best regard to Representative Jensen from my district. After hearing President Frommeyer, I am moved. It is fantastic. And I'm here to represent ETEC, or Engineering Technology Industry Council, which was created by the legislators in 1997. And it had a fantastic result-oriented council that I would like to share some of that with you today. I was interested in what President Frommeyer talked about the value of education and higher education and so on. I came to this country as an 18-year-old guy from Iran. Didn't speak the language, but I went and did my undergraduate work, graduate work, and now I own two separate companies, one in Hermiston, one in Portland, high-tech company and an agricultural company. But as an interesting sidebar, my company in Hermiston, which is involved in the large agribusinesses, right now, if you don't have any kind of a technology background, you cannot work in a farm. Our tractors are autonomous, robotic, that it drives by itself. It's all electronics. If you touch the wheel, the tractor will stop because it knows it can drive millimeter accuracy, and instead of depending on light, it depends on global satellite that it can run 24/7 rather than traditional 5 years ago, which we were running it only 8 hours a day. Food safety, as we can see, the nano tracing, working with the Oregon State University with Dean Dodson, that is our future, how we can trace our food safety. So for sure, even in a traditional business like agriculture, technology where it's at. In a 2006 National Academy of Science report stated that the world-class science and engineering is the principal means of creating new jobs for our country. I always said, and I think with Representative Jensen, I always told them, you cannot compare muscle to muscle power. We've got to be creative. We've got to use technology. And we are the nerd that have the last laugh. And I'm going to talk about the value of engineering and sciences. The ETEC Council, represented by a wide range of industry representative. Intel, HP, ESI, LSI Logic, Jelvin from Klamath Basin, and so on. And we have our council oversees the investment of the state and adds its own money to promote higher education. Our council has one thing in common, our shared belief in higher education and increasing opportunity for our students, increasing productivity through research and development. And some of them has been mentioned by President Frommeyer. We cover a large geographical area and oversee the fund that fund the eight universities. All of the eight universities, they have different strength in different areas. Some of them are in engineering, computer science, IT, biomedical, and but overall, they are providing fantastic value in innovation and technology. By, as President Frommeyer mentioned, under-investing in this area, in our university, is not to the best interest of Oregon and our future.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zawari, the last slide. I would argue, and I'll just give you a contrary point of view, that this slide is almost, my first blush look at it is almost, that it doesn't work in ETIC's favor, and here's why, is because every university is listed. And so I think that what that says, not very subtly to me and perhaps to others, because ETIC doesn't have as much legislative involvement as Oregon Inc. or other councils we've set up to work on similar type problem or environments, is we took some of the resources and said yes to every institution. But I would put that out to yourself to argue that perhaps we said no, we took a hard look and we said no to some institutions because they just simply didn't fit investing in excellence and the ETIC mission of taking finite resources and really, like 2X or 5X, really driving towards some defined goal. And therefore we had to tell some of our institutions this is not the funding source ETIC is.
Senator Decker, Mr. Chairman, you are right about that. Although we do fund all eight universities to certain degrees, we have three main focuses. Our main focus is to fund enough of Oregon State University so it is ranked within top 25 engineering. By attracting faculties, high-level faculties throughout that attract students, attract research. So we are very focused from our from industry's point of view. We are also focused to PSU and University of Oregon. But from their main focus is to make sure at least we have one ranked university, which is at this point is Oregon State University.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could just quibble, given the presentation that we had yesterday from the Chancellor and what President Frommeyer just laid out for us in terms of the unfortunate story of the state's role in disinvesting in higher education, and we've got a good committee here that I think is hoping to start reinvesting and reversing that decline. But given the environment that we've been in, I might argue that we should use ETIC to achieve one or two goals, and the ones I'm most familiar with are the 2X, top 25, and really limit and focus our efforts to something that we are making progress, undoubtedly, and achieving, and that requires us to perhaps say no to other endeavors that just simply, in this tight environment, we just simply cannot do. And we can talk offline more about ETIC, because certainly something that's in the higher ed budget. I know this committee is focused on.
I appreciate that, and hopefully we'll talk some more. When you look at the supply and demand curve, from 2004 to 2014, to replace engineering, basically in Oregon, by a new engineer and also replace the people that were there, we need over 2,800 engineers. With the rate that we were going before, at most we will create 11,000, so about half of the engineers. So we need to ramp up our engineering and sciences so we can create more engineering, and as we mentioned, our goal of 2x is where we are really emphasizing. And that would leave us with two choices. One is we got to recruit engineers from other area of the country or globe, or the companies that are here have to move to where the engineers are. So those are the choices we have. As an industry member, we are very, very concerned about it. And I am the best example of it. I just could not find enough engineers in Eastern Oregon, although my preference would have been, so I moved one of my company to Portland 3 years ago. But that was sheer need that we had for engineers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Fred, welcome, and it's great to see you, and appreciate your being here, and I think you have a lot to bring for us. But just kind of a personal question. Did you contemplate at all maybe moving your second company to India? what I'm hearing is they are producing significantly more engineers than we are, some pretty high quality programs there. I'm just curious whether those thoughts.
The sad news is, Representative Jensen, that we do hire engineers and programmers from India, even for my agricultural business. It just seems odd, but we have to find engineers and programmers and computer science people that can develop and keep up with our growth. And about a year ago, we have 4 or 5 people that work in India just in our program that we can deliver to Oregon farmers in Eastern Oregon. I'm not intending to move the company there, but we do use resources from India. I never thought I would do that, never. But that's the need that we have to fill. Can other companies look at the same way?
Mr. Chair and members, I think, you know, I've known Mr. Jerry, ever since I became involved in the legislature thing and watched his company grow and watched his, the development of what he's done and what he does. I think it's a beautiful example. His company is a beautiful example of what we can do and of what potentials are out there. And I think he's a little modest sometimes in explaining what he does. I would suggest he's also been international in his approach to marketing and to working outside of the boundaries of the United States. And when he's telling us that a successful program like he has that he winds up having to go out of the nation to import the types of personnel that he needs to make his company go. A small little company that starts out in rural Eastern Oregon, I think that sends us a very, very strong message about where we're at. In this supply and demand as far as engineers and scientists at the present time. So, and I'm sorry if I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to make those comments for you.
Thank you very much, Representative Jensen. Mr. Chairman, the ETEX history shows that we believe in public-private partnership. We as an industry want to be partner with the state to generate that global through education, higher education and research. We have two major goals. One is to double the number of engineers that are graduated from in engineering and sciences from our universities. and our goal is to achieve that by 2013 and bring five times the federal research by 2020. E-Techs, again, we invest on universities. These are some of the type of research that different universities are doing, as you are familiar with, especially in the high-tech area. Our E-Tech affiliate, we fund, project, and invest in Saudi Academy, OMSI, and other affiliates to fill the pipeline, especially to increase awareness in science, technology, mathematics within high school and pre-colleges. We have been very, very successful. This is, again, as President Frommeyer mentioned. For every dollar the state invests, the private industry are investing in our engineering by a factor of two to one. So that's a very, very good buy, which magnifies the benefits to the Oregon and Oregon economy. We are very goal-oriented and result-oriented in our council. We have, since our inception, by 2005-06, we increased our number of graduates in engineering by 38%. And our hope is by 2008-09 to increase that to by 57% from our base, and by 2013 by doubling the number of this graduate. It is interesting to say Intel hired 450 PhDs and 6 came from Oregon. Our federal dollar, our goal is to, by 2020, multiply it by 5, our research, through hiring of faculties. So we have, for example, since our base, we increased it by 20 million, and our goal is 81 million in attracting federal research. This is where the heart of the why we are here asking for your help. We ask the governor's budget of $17 million to be instated. That will create 33 faculties, 6 staff, 19 graduate assistants, and classroom, laboratories, and so on. The same thing will bring $28 million in private funding from companies like ours, and a $15 million federal research, which creates innovation and work-ready graduates. So the bottom line is, we believe in bringing our strategy of doubling this engineering and creating research to increase innovation in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Ziyari. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ziyari, what is the relationship between the amount of state support and the number of graduates and or the research dollars? Is there a linear relationship there?
Well, it's not quite linear, but if I understand your question, if you are not able to get the other extra $10 million above the co-chairs, mm-hmm. I think instead of hiring 33 faculties, we'll be winding up about a third, around 13 faculties. And we also will lose about $25 million worth of outside source of funding, like a private funding and a federal funding. So that's quite a big, significant impact on our program. And also, it would be basically a mediocre effort in engineering and technology effort. So we are just humping around. Mm-hmm. But
Mr. Chair,
innovation.
So again, hypothetically, if you were funded at the co-chairs level, just $7 million, how would that impact achieving the goals you outlined earlier in terms of the number of degrees awarded in the federal research dollars?
It would be, as I said, we will just just go on the same level as we were doing in the past, mm-hmm. but forget about ranking Oregon as number one or OSU, as we mentioned, as it being ranked in the top 25, or bring in high-level researchers so attract high faculty that want to be in Oregon. We just don't have the fund to do that. Mm-hmm. So we suffer from lack of, which creates lack of innovation and lack of student graduation and so on.
Mr. Chair, one last follow-up.
Sure, follow-up.
Do you have a sense of how far back it would extend your timeline? In other words, if your goal is to have twice as many graduates by the year 2013, are we talking about, you know, extending that another 5 years, another 10 years?
Our council, Representative Edwards, our council looked at it. We really needed to be about $34 million to meet our goals.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cut in half at the governor's budget. Now that budget is cut by another $10 million. As I said, it will not achieve the goal that we set for excellence in engineering and innovation. We can talk about it, but mm-hmm. we are not going to get there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Sam
Morrison. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, the $28 million in private support, what payroll dollars would that represent from the contributing companies? I'm curious, and there are some reasons why I'm asking this, they're broader than this discussion, what we're going to hear, but I'm curious as to what, if you have the idea of what percentage of the payroll dollars in women's companies $28 million would represent.
Senator Morris, I really don't have a good feel for it. I'll get that number for you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just kind of on the same tack or questions that Representative Edwards are asking, I guess the natural question that flows into my mind, and first of all, Mr. Zoller, we should all extend our thanks to you. I know the pay for being chair of ETIC is incredibly high, and all the time that you spend in Salem is rewarding, and so it's private sector leaders like yourself that we just show a great deal of gratitude towards. I guess the question I'm wondering, and perhaps the Bruce Schaefer from ETIC or others could answer this, is how is the investment, Tier 1, 2X, I'm there, sponsored the bill a few sessions ago. It's important. We've got to keep driving toward focusing on it, working on it. And I guess the thing I'm grappling with is I look at the ETIC agendas. How is our investments that get off that track, helping towards what should be our prime focus? And I'm thinking of some of the other investments embedded in the ETIC proposal that to me don't really keep us focused on ensuring that you don't have to make those difficult decisions of where to locate a growing, thriving business. If you wanted to keep it in Hermiston, that would be the goal, or Portland's great. And that you're not having to import that talent. And that's, I guess, what I'm struggling with is an investment that got off that focus.
We had a long discussion within our industry council. As I mentioned, our industry council, most talented industry leaders in the world are sitting there and discussing this thing. We discussed really one of the areas that, you know, it's just not enough to put funding to attract to graduate students. You got to get top students. So you can attract people from all over the globe. So our strategy is, we became aware that we do live in a global market, not an Oregon market. That was it's a big revelation for all of us to realize. As I mentioned to Senator Jensen 5 years ago, if you asked me, do you go to India to attract, to bring your resources? Absolutely not. In agriculture, for that matter, would have been totally out of question. This is just a realization of our today's age we live in, that we do need to be competitive. We need to bring high-level scientists and attract them to Oregon through, you know, mainly ranking and paying attention to the basically ranking in engineering. I don't think we are off track. I think our goals have been just, we ask all of the university, step up to the plate, don't be mediocre. Mediocrity was an option. We ask them for higher level of involvement.
We're going to have a more on ETEC.
Yeah, and I'm a little worried because we only have a half hour and we've got several more folks, so yeah, I appreciate it. So,
had you concluded, Mr. Zari?
I have.
Mr. Simon, thank you very much, and I hope that we can count on your support for ETEC.
Well, thank you again for coming.
Appreciate
your testimony. Okay, I'm going to call up Professor Jun Zhao. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. And Sarah Corbis, who's a doctoral student. Welcome. Good afternoon.
That's that. Good afternoon. Thank you for letting me speak today. And for your record, I'm Jun Zhao, a professor in the physics department at Portland State University. I also have a joint position in the electrical and computer engineering at Portland State. I'm also a director for the Center for Electron Microscopy and Nanofabrication at PSU. This center is designated as one of the signature centers in the Omami, which consists of UFO, OSU, PSU, and Pacific Northwest National Laboratory and several high-tech companies in the Oregon. So I joined the PSU from the University of Arizona in 1999 as an assistant professor. My research expertise is in the electron microscopy, nanoscience, and nanotechnology. I have extensive experience in synthesizing carbon nanotubes, which are the most promising nanoscale materials for the future electronics. These materials are so small, and 16,000 of such nanotubes combined together equal is just one single human hair. So with such small materials, without electron microscope, it's just impossible for us to do the research. So we need an electron high-power, high-resolution electron microscope. So with this demand, I decided to collaborate with my colleagues, and we write a proposal, ask of more than $1 million from the National Science Foundation to fund this project. And then during this proposal preparation, and we recognize the more than 20 faculty members at the PSU, as well as the local and the sister universities, and more than a dozen local industry. And we also need this equipment because those small and mid-sized companies, they don't have this capability to operate, and also they are lacking of expertise in this area. So with this support, and we submitted this proposal to the National Science Foundation. Unfortunately, the proposal was declined, and three times in 3 years. The major concern from the panel of reviewers was that in this area, we don't think we have a strong infrastructure to convince the reviewers that we can handle such a sophisticated instrument. So the reviewer also questioned about our capability and sustainability in this area. So although they recognize we do need such instrument, but they are afraid, give us money, we may not be able to keep them running in the long term. So I showed this one of the reviewer in particular says in the comments says this PI demonstrated good credential to lead the project. This assistant professor wants to change the history of the PSU in this area, but it is questionable that the university is capable of supporting the operation of the instrument in the long term. When I showed this reviewer's comments to our dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Science and the vice provost for research at PSU, and they were hurt. And they analyzed this proposal, recognized the impact involving this large number of faculty members and their graduate students. Also, the large number of companies which also need this instrument. They made a very profound decision, which is redistribute the limited budget which the state provided PSU. We convinced all the department chairs from the science the college contribute partial of their funding to this project based on the number of faculties involving this project. Once we get this money and we use this state funds, then we convinced the local company, which is FER companies, the manufacturer of such a powerful microscope. We thought, okay, we want to be part of this process to change the history of PSU and Oregon. So we got this powerful microscope. Soon after that, Intel called us and said, we want to donate you another one, which make it stronger. Based on these two powerful microscopes, my colleague and I immediately wrote two proposals, one to the Murdoch Foundation, which Murdoch's charitable trust, one to the National Science Foundation, asked for another two powerful microscopes, which has a complementary capability to the existing two. And then so we got funded both proposals about more than $1 million. So right now we built such a facility. It's the best in the Pacific Northwest among the universities. So this is an example I wanted to present to you. You know, if you invest the seed money, we can bring in more money, just like President Florian Mayer said. So we can do this. So I wanted to use this example to give you assurance that the faculty, the devotion, and the administrators' support, we Oregon can do this. So based on this achievement, I just want to give you an example what this facility did. And right now, we are well recognized as leader in this area. And our student, I'll give you an example. Our student, one of my first PhD students right now, just 7 years at PSU, right now he's a tenure track assistant professor at Missouri State University. And also, and two of my PhD students got a national award based on their scientific paper, also supported by this powerful microscope, which got the results other people cannot get. We have four master's students got a regional and also local award. And I have 70 undergraduate students who was trained in this facility, which we recruit nationwide and as a grant called the research experience for the undergraduate students. And also there are five high school students in the last five years. Every summer we offer one position in this center, allow the high school student, local high school student, senior to join this program. So those five students, they all went to college, two in Harvard, one in Caltech, one in Cornell, one in Whitman College. But you may ask, where should we in Oregon? That is also a problem. So our undergraduate students, the high school students, they want to search for the power for good undergraduate program. They want to use a university because they offer them a high fellowship and a very good research, a very good undergraduate program, very good this educational environment. So we do have we attract our students as well, but a lot of very talented, top students, they went to other out-state university. This is something, although it doesn't sound very, attractive, but I think it's a problem. As a professor, I wanted to tell you. One of the five students all wrote me a thanks letter and told me how much my students have helped them. This is very, I call it bittersweet for me. And I'm happy we helped them to enter such a, top universities. Also, I feel sad which they don't stay here to study for the undergraduate students. So this is something I wanted to tell you as it concerns those professors. So that we have good things, like I want to follow President Florian Mayer's comments. We have capability if you support us. For instance, since I got this microscopes in the last 5 years, my colleague and I, just only in this program, we brought in more than $5 million from the National Science Foundation. Currently, I have six NSF fund at the same time. Even my colleague from Harvard said very few colleagues in our university run six NSF grant at the same time. So today I tell you it's not to humble. I just want to know this can happen in Oregon. So, and also, based on this facility, we have many faculty can write a proposal to the ASF, make them no longer question about our capability in this area. But we still need a lot of help. For instance, I want to tell you that not only we need to build new buildings, some of the infrastructure at PSU is very old. Science building 2, for instance, my office is located on the third floor and across from this chemistry organic lab. And constantly there is a very strange smell enter my office. The problem is the ventilation system is so old, constantly shut down by itself. You have to constantly watch. So one day the smell is so strong, I almost just feel I have terrible headache. I called the facility, called the physics department chair, called the chemistry department chair. I said, you have to come upstairs to fail. I said, if we don't solve this problem, the students and the faculty will get poisoned badly. Someday. And so they immediately take the action, did some temporary, you know, if it's shut off and then you turn it down, just keep watching, right? In the meantime, I'm in that committee for this, the board of committee for this renovation program. I know we submitted the proposal to the state with the hope you will help us to renovate this old building, enable us to teach this undergraduate student and to run the research. Right now, the chemistry department, when we are waiting for the money, the chemistry department has redesigned this lab to not let it have a smell so that we can wait. So as you can see, when the Oregon University, which hear us to change the program based on the restriction of the building, so I don't blame if our high school student, the top high school student, go to Harvard and MIT. So I think this is a serious problem. I wish you can help us. So I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zhao.
Ms. Corbis.
For the record, my name is Sarah Corbis. I'm a PhD candidate at Portland State University. I'm also a Frank L. Roberts Scholar, and I've been nominated for the University Club Scholarship as well. My research is on population structure of island-associated dolphins. I work with the National Marine Fisheries Service and other management agencies, and I also work internationally in French Polynesia and with their management agencies as well. Most of my work revolves around genetic studies and photo identification, and my research at Portland State has been funded at this point by 17 different organizations, scholarships, grants, and six of which are directly related to Portland State, which was a big draw for me to come to Portland State because they have endowments and they have funding that's available for their students. A lot of that, I think, is related to alumni feeling that it's worth investing in their Oregon universities. The faculty has grown considerably at Portland State as well. Their biology faculty is very diverse now and has a lot of new and exciting things going on. This is also true, I know, at the other Oregon universities. My main draw to Portland State was my advisor. Having high-quality faculty there at the top of their field is a huge draw, particularly in the sciences, for students. In addition, we also look at funding facilities and courses and projects available. Right now, the facilities are our main problem. As Joan said, there's just a terrible situation with the ventilation in our building. We've had similar problems in my lab. We've also had flooding where expensive equipment has been destroyed because the building isn't adequately sealed. The pipes are bad. There's serious problems with that building, and we need to do something about it. In addition, I'm a teacher's assistant. So as a teacher's assistant, I know firsthand what the situation is working with the undergraduates in the labs. Right now, we offer 6 a.m. labs, 9 to midnight labs, Saturday and Sunday labs, in order to accommodate what I believe is over 600 undergraduate students. But there's still...
Ms. Corbett, yeah. Just for clarification,
sure.
So just so you know, this committee, we had a hearing at Portland State, and we actually toured Lincoln, and we saw, and also, I mean, the bill in front of us, what we're doing is really focused on operations, and we're not really, I mean, I understand that it's part and parcel of capital construction, but so if you can, and I'm just a little concerned about time too, because we have a couple more, so anything have, you know, concerning the operations can be your best focus, so
okay.
I'm not talking about the capital, but the buildings per se.
Okay. I don't know that I can really speak to the operations.
I guess what I'm saying, in other words, not. We understand there are infrastructure issues, and those are very important, but that's not sort of would be in this bill, right? That would be it's kind of really a separate bill. But you were talking about, for example, your advisor and that and attracting you and.
Well, with respect to the just in general, I think that it's important to look at Oregon education as a K through college rather than just a K through 12. So we don't want to have our good students leave the state, and we want to attract students who are going to bring in funding. And the science department, as everyone else has said, generates millions of dollars, and a lot of that goes into the overhead that the university uses just to run the entire university. So we're an important part, and we also are global. Scientists, I'm collaborating with people from 5 different countries. We are an international collaborator, so we bring in dollars even from out of the country, and that money is spent here in Oregon. We create internships, we have job shadowing, we make volunteer opportunities in our universities, and I think that's really important for the K-12 as well. I personally go out into the K-12 and give presentations to the students. I talk about marine biology. I talk to high school students about careers and how they can go about getting into college and the opportunities that are available here in Oregon. And I want to be able to go out there and tell them that they can get a good quality education here in Oregon. They don't have to go out of state. And at Portland State also, we offer an education to people who are coming back to school. And so we give them the opportunity to not move out of state or quit their job or, you know, things like that, uproot a family. They can stay here in Portland and get a good quality education. And in order to make that continue to happen, we really do need to work on upgrading some of our facilities and funding our Oregon State higher education system. I think it's a benefit to our communities. Portland State actually requires its students to do community service as part of their degree, and a lot of people participate in that community service regardless. And so I think that if we invest in our Oregon schools, we can continue to draw in those good top quality students and keep our good students here from Oregon, and they're going to be the employers, the business owners, the high skilled laborers that we want to have here in Portland, generating our economy and contributing to our communities. Thank you.
Thank you, and I think anyone on this dais would love to come with you to French Polynesia. So thank you very much, Dr. Zhao. Thank you very much. Dr. Ray, thank you for sitting patiently. A lot of passion and excitement, so thanks for taking more.
Chair Galizio, members of the committee, good afternoon. I am Ed Ray, president of Oregon State University, and I appreciate the opportunity to address you regarding the OSU statewide public service programs. I can tell you, based on 37 years working in land-grant institutions, that the people working in the OSU Extension Service, Forest Research Lab, and Agricultural Experiment Station have got it right in terms of what their job is and how to do it effectively. I think our programs are unmatched across the country. They're developing the knowledge base and extending the university to people where they live and work. They're talking to them about what their needs and issues are, and they're helping them develop solutions that address the problems that they have. From the accounts I've seen of the regional hearings you conducted across the state last week, I know you heard from people in each of the locations who were genuinely concerned about the co-chair's budget and how it will affect our ability to deliver programs in every county in the state, and I can tell you that I share their concern. The Forest Research Lab and Experiment Station are, in effect, the research offices for a vast majority of the state's landmass, not to mention the state's economic backbone. Dean Saulwasser and Dean Dutson are prepared to recount for you how these programs ensure a productive economy everywhere in Oregon. These research enterprises are critical to generating new revenues that you need to fund every program in Oregon from K-12 to public safety. Dollar for dollar, every investment you make in the OSU statewides will produce one of the highest returns on investment of any program in Oregon. Well, I know that a number of you know about 4-H and Master Gardener programs as part of the OSU Extension Service. The Extension Service is also pivotal in improving
improving the lives of people who face the daily challenge of putting food on the table. Our food and nutrition programs improve the cost effectiveness of food stamps and the women's, infants, and children's programs by providing the tools that people need to purchase and prepare nutritional meals on extremely limited incomes. Through concerted work with stakeholders across the state, these three programs developed a recommendation for a $15 million policy option package for the 2007-09 biennium. The State Board of Higher Education recommended this package for inclusion in the governor's budget. Seeking to balance a vast array of needs across the state, the governor's budget included $5.5 million of this package. I should note that this is the first time since 1999 that any of these programs have been included in the governor's budget with a programmatic increase. The budget proposed by the co-chairs eliminates any programmatic increases. In essence, we've gone from $15 million to zero. This is of great concern to me given the return on investments, the history of funding for these programs, and the value these programs extend to every corner of the state. Each session, we have relied on extensive legislative support to help recover these programs from potential reductions, and I greatly appreciate the support you have provided in the past. I am hopeful that we can work with you in the current biennium to address the potential harm that will come not to these programs, but to people in the industries in Oregon who rely upon them. Let me now turn to the deans and directors of these programs to describe what they can accomplish for you with the additional resources requested and the impact those resources will have on Oregon's economic vitality. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ray.
Chair Galizio and members of the subcommittee, I'm Hal Salwasser. I'm the director of the Oregon Forest
that's
Research.
I'm just talking about time, right? So I understand that Monday, can you help me with the calendar? Monday, there was...
Yes, Mr. Chair. The department is scheduled to return for additional testimony on Monday and Tuesday of next week. On Wednesday, we've scheduled public testimony. On Thursday, you offer the department an additional day of public testimony, and they have requested that. If they don't need the full time, we could, if it's helpful, allocate some of Thursday's time to more agency presentation as well. I know you're concerned about not having enough time to hear properly from the deans.
I'm wondering if, so in other words, it sounds like Monday, either Monday would be preferable, or if that's doable, or if the Thursday is, and I don't know what your
Mr. Chair,
Wednesday.
Can I make a suggestion?
Sure, that is important.
Because we'll be continuing these hearings all through next week, would it be possible just to not take the subject up until we come back on Monday so that we can hear this whole section at one time and then just continue through the sequence that the system has? And then and it's difficult to rearrange the public testimony,
right.
But if we don't get finished with the sequence that the system has, then finish it up on Thursday.
No, that makes sense. I just don't know.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I can discuss this with the department after the meeting as to the best time for rescheduling these appearances.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I hate to just start for 2 minutes and then interrupt you. I'm sorry, it's frustrating because you come all the way here. I don't want to sort of talk for 2 minutes and then not to have the opportunity to hear all of the presentation. So working with Mr. Bender, and I think that's probably going to be the most logical way to do this, so we get the committee gets a full sense. And I apologize for the inconvenience of this. So with that, I think what we're going to do is I'm going to close the hearing on 5515 to be continued, and we are adjourned. Thank you very much.